Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The UN Human Rights Council opened a four-week session in Geneva on Monday with multiple emergencies from Afghanistan to Ukraine set to take center stage. Just over 200 days since Russia invaded its neighbor, Acting High Commissioner for Human Rights Nada Al-Nashif said that throughout Ukraine the suffering of the civilian population continues. A special independent commission of inquiry on Ukraine is due for the first time to deliver its findings on possible war crimes to the Council on the 23rd of September. It was tasked with investigating grave abuses in Kyiv, Cherniviv, Kharkiv and Sumy regions. Beyond the war-torn country, fuel shortages and food security concerns are now the norm in some of the world's poorest countries, the acting UN rights chief said.
I welcome and call for the full respect of the landmark agreement involving Russia, Ukraine, the United Nations and Turkey in July, which allowed the resumption of shipments of grain and other food supplies from Ukrainian ports. And I urge the international community to ensure that the food reaches the people who need it.
A staggering 50 million people live in modern slavery today, according to the Global Estimates of Modern Slavery report, which indicates that 28 million people had to do forced labor last year, and another 22 million were trapped in forced marriage. The International Labour Organization, ILO, and International Organization for Migration, IOM, the two UN agencies behind the report, said that forced labor and arranged marriages have increased by around 10 million people in the last 5 years, with women and children affected most. According to the report's findings, modern slavery occurs in almost every country in the world and cuts across ethnic, cultural and religious lines. More than half of all forced labor and a quarter of all forced marriages can be found in upper middle income or high income countries. An estimated 6.3 million people in Sri Lanka now face moderate to severe acute food insecurity. That's the warning from UN humanitarians at the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, and the World Food Programme, WFP, who've said that the situation in Sri Lanka will likely worsen because of poor agricultural production, price spikes and ongoing economic crisis. Two consecutive seasons of poor harvests led to a nearly 50% drop in production. The country's sovereign debt default in April has also reduced imports of food grains, according to the FAO and WFP, who insist that immediate food assistance and livelihood programs are critical to ensuring that households receive nutritious food. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, in May of this year, a white supremacist killed 10 people in Buffalo, New York. He made clear that he wanted to kill black people because he believes there's a plot run by Jews to replace white people with black and brown people. News media had an opportunity to deeply interrogate the obvious spurs for the horrific act, including, of course, the media outlets and pundits and politicians who themselves repeatedly invoke this white replacement idea. But it didn't really happen. Counterspin spoke at the time about issues we hoped more media would be exploring with Matt Gertz, senior fellow at Media Matters for America, who's been following Fox News and Tucker Carlson for years. And we spoke also with Eric K. Ward, senior fellow at Southern Poverty Law Center and executive director at Western State Center, about ways to move forward. We're going to hear that conversation again today, but first a very quick look at some recent press. After the car bomb assassination of Russian journalist Daria Dugina, the daughter of an influential pro-Kremlin political philosopher, U.S. media outlets quickly branded the 29-year-old as not a journalist, but an agent in Russia's disinformation war. CNN stated that she was on the front lines of Russia's war effort and linked her to Russia's vast disinformation machine. They reported that Dugina's killing shed light on the inner workings of a Russian media sphere that unquestioningly parrots Kremlin talking points. But, lacking in self-awareness, CNN relied heavily on U.S. State Department reports to do that. Dugina, readers were told, played a role in, quote, advancing Russian soft power, assailing the West in TV appearances, close quote. And they cite another Russian journalist statement that when Russia is at war, we are, of course, on the side of Russia, as if they were shocked, simply shocked at that notion. Except for those of us who remember, for instance, September 2001, when esteemed U.S. journalist Dan Rather stated, George Bush is the president, he makes the decisions, and wherever he wants me to line up, just tell me where. There is obviously much to criticize about Russia's actions and those of their media, but when CNN and others talk about Russia's disinformation apparatus with a thinly veiled implication that nothing remotely similar exists or could exist in the United States, well, we just know too much to accept that. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. There are some tropes about corporate news media that you wonder if people even wonder at them anymore. Did you catch that when Michael Brown was killed by law enforcement at age 18 in Ferguson, Missouri, AP described him as a black man, but the white 18-year-old who killed 10 people in a Buffalo supermarket because it was in a black neighborhood and he's a racist, AP instructs readers to understand as a teenager. That language level bias is meaningful. But in the case of the racist hate-based crime of this past week, the media question is also writ very large. I will surprise no one by saying that Fox News and primetime host Tucker Carlson see there is no relationship whatsoever in the Buffalo Killer's explicit reference to the same white replacement theory that they have been pushing for years and his acting in response to those ideas that, again, they have pushed night after night with vigor. At a certain point, the rest of U.S. civil society pretending that white supremacy is not a central factor in our conversation and our politics becomes a dangerously willful ignorance. Our next guest has been surveying this swamp and its meaning and its impact for years now. Matt Gertz is senior fellow at Media Matters for America. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Matt Gertz.
Thank you for having me.
Well, depending on which day of the week you ask me, frankly, I have different thoughts about how and whether to respond to people in media, but also in life, who are saying, without defending this mass murder, they're saying that when people talk about immigration, they're not saying to hurt people, you know, immigration, demographic shifts. That's just, you know, language. It seems important to acknowledge when you hear a Fox News host talking about demographic shifts, it's not a wild interpretive leap to say that they're actually, you know, calling for some sort of action. You've been talking about those connections for years now, right?
I have been, yes. I've been working at Media Matters in some capacity or another for almost 14 years, and in that time I've spent much of my career surveying Fox News and the various threads that run through it. Yeah, and I have to say, in the speed and completeness with which a white supremacist conspiracy theory took hold on the nation's most popular cable news network is really quite astounding. When we talk about the great replacement theory, I think we're often talking about a couple of different things. I mean, the U.S. has obviously a long history of xenophobia. America is sort of a competition between our best ideals, in which we imagine that we can bring new people into our body politic and all be Americans together. And sort of backlash that comes against that, that came against the Irish and the Italians and Eastern European Jews and so on and so forth down through the decades, the fear-mongering, the idea that the other is joining America in a way that spoils it, mm-hmm. that in some way makes it dirtier. So there's that long story. More recently, though, the Great Replacement is a very particular conspiracy theory that I think builds on those long hatreds. And this is the idea that there is some shadowy force that is deliberately bringing in unchecked immigrants, an invasion of them, and that the purpose of that is to replace the white populace, and in doing so, gain and retain power. That is a very dangerous phrasing. The idea of replacing one race with another is something that almost by definition seems to require some sort of active response to it.
Right. Some people belong to be here. If you say replacement, that means people being pushed out who are rightfully here by implicitly people who are not rightfully here.
Yes. And so this was an idea that in its recent form popped over from Europe in 2011. It was this essay by a Frenchman who wrote in 2011 that French society, white French society, was going to be replaced by Muslim immigrants. And that idea was sort of ported over across the sea to America, and sort of when it was incorporated into the sort of standard white supremacist discourse here, the people who were bringing about this replacement were often described as Jews. And anti-black racism obviously took on a key role. Anti-black racism, anti-Latino racism, and you know it took on more of a racial character than the religious one that it had over in France. At first, this was largely confined to explicit white supremacist spaces. It's the sort of thing you'd read if you were on the neo-Nazi Stormfront website or something like that. It was really kept out of mainstream discourse, but it's not anymore. It's really everywhere. And the reason for that is Tucker Carlson and Fox News. Tucker made it his mission to bring this white supremacist conspiracy theory into the mainstream, to sanitize it just a little bit so he could get it on the air without it being like incredibly obvious what he was doing. He started doing this around 2018, and over the years he's become more and more explicit in his language until it's really not different at all from the manifesto that shooter put out. You don't have to read that manifesto. It's not pleasant reading, but you can also get much of the same material if you just turn on Fox News. The conspiracy theory is recited almost on a nightly basis for an audience of millions of people.
Well, it's so meaningful, and I think that Counterspin listeners know that there are such worldviews and ideologies at work, and that sometimes they're given platform, and that sometimes others are marginalized. But I think that listeners do understand that this supposedly ideological battle is being fought out in the context of corporate capitalism. And Tucker Carlson didn't put up a lemonade stand and become a millionaire because his lemonade is better. He's supported and held up and pushed in front of people by a system and a structure that, if we can't say they wanted him there, we can certainly say they're happy with him being sustained there. And I just wonder, how do we try and move the conversation from, you know, this twerp with his dumb ideas to what we could actually push on to change, to push aside the interest in maintaining this kind of
the fountain of harm and hatred.
You're certainly right that he is not some sort of lone actor. He is in his position because Rupert Murdoch and his son Lachlan Murdoch want him there. And he is doing, frankly, his job. He's doing exactly what the Fox News brass wants him to do. They want his blood-soaked conspiracy theories. If they didn't, they could stop him.
It's, right.
You know, always sort of unclear whether they're doing it because they have an affinity with what he's saying, whether they agree with him, or if they're simply doing it purely for the money. But if they're doing it for the money, I think that the option available is to try to remove the profitability of Tucker Carlson for Americans to tell advertisers, we don't want you advertising on Fox News. They're promoting hate and bigotry and, frankly, domestic terrorism. To tell cable carriers, we want an option not to have a bundle that includes Fox News, so that we don't give them our money every month when we pay our cable bills. But that's the leverage point, making it not profitable for Fox News to have this kind of hate on its airwaves.
Well, I think it's a big thing to say. Part of what we're critiquing at FAIR is corporate ownership and sponsorship of media and the leverage that they exert. But given that they exert that leverage, well, exert it, you know. I'll just ask you finally, because I know it's the latest thing, upfronts. Those are places where outlets talk to advertisers and talk to media buyers and they talk to stockholders and that sort of thing. That kind of conversation, that kind of behind-the-scenes conversation is where we heard Les Moonves of CBS say, Donald Trump is bad for America, but he's good for CBS, so let's do it. We just had upfronts for Fox 2 days ago. No indication there that they are thinking, oh my gosh, people were just murdered based on ideas we're putting out there. Let's think about that. That was not the vibe.
To the contrary, to some extent, they were rubbing a lot of this in the faces of the advertisers. I mean, the timing for them is really obviously quite bad. They were holding this conference, bringing in the nation's leading advertisers and media buyers 48 hours after a mass shooting in which the shooter repeated the same talking points that you can hear on Fox News any given night. And so they did not talk about Tucker Carlson, I think, quite deliberately at that event. But the person that they had instead flacking for the company was Pete Hegseth, who is another Fox News host who has said that there is a full-scale invasion of migrants coming to your backyard. It's much of the same replacement theory language as Carlson does. I mean, it's also one of the network's biggest defenders of the January 6th insurrection. And then there were no apologies, obviously, for Fox News from the Fox News lineup. In fact, they seemed quite clear that they want to brand themselves as victims, that facing criticism in the way that they have is somehow unfair and unjust to them. So they are clearly not giving advertisers much to work with other than to accept that if they continue funding this network, then what they're doing is giving money for white supremacist propaganda.
Well, we're going to end it there for now. We've been speaking with Matt Garretts. He's senior fellow at Media Matters for America. They keep receipts on this sort of thing, and you can find them online at mediamatters.org. Matt Garretts, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
You may have heard the Buffalo mass shooting described as senseless, and in some ways that is true, but in other ways less so, because we know the man who killed 10 people and wounded 3 others was armed not just with military gear and weaponry, but with a particular set of ideas about white people like himself in existential peril, and that these ideas in various forms are being promulgated in an alarming number of places today. It's not about trying to read the mind of a murderer, but thinking about what systems and institutions and ideas contribute to such a horrific act, and what different things need to happen to prevent its recurrence. Our guest has been working on these issues for many years now. Eric K. Ward is a senior fellow with the Southern Poverty Law Center and executive director of Western States Center. He was the 2021 recipient of the Train Foundation's Civil Courage Award, the first American to receive that honor. He joins us now by phone from Portland, Oregon. Welcome to Counterspin, Eric Ward.
Such a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me. I'm sorry that it is around yet another tragedy.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I think that a lot of people have avoided learning about this stuff. It's toxic and upsetting, and why give it space in your head, you know? So with the acknowledgement that knowing about the particular fear and anger that by his own account drove this man's violent actions, that's not the same thing as appeasing it. So acknowledging that, what should we know about white replacement theory and the worldview that it offers?
We have to understand that at the end of the day, there is another social movement on the terrain of America, and it is not one grounded in the inclusion of racial, environmental, and economic social justice groups. It is one that is grounded in exclusion and ethnic cleansing, and it's known as white nationalism. White nationalism has a narrative, and that narrative is called the replacement theory. It is a story that teaches that a secret elite are at work to destroy white Christian America through immigration, through interracial dating, through expanding civil rights for the LGBTQ community. The list goes on. But we should all be clear that replacement theory is merely a retelling of an old anti-Semitic narrative called the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, a forged anti-Semitic document by Russian Tsarist police from 1903. It's the same story. It tells the story of a secret Jewish conspiracy seeking to destroy European Christendom. And it was brought here to America by Henry Ford, proliferated to tens of thousands of Americans. It was used to justify or try to explain why white segregationists lost against the black civil rights movement of the 1960s. And today it's being called replacement theory, and it's being used to justify racial terror of Jews, Muslims, African Americans, Latinos, Asians, and others. But not only is it being driven by the white nationalist movement, irresponsibly, there are cynical elected officials who are promoting and credentializing this anti-Semitic theory. And it's not only killing Jews, it is killing all of us. And we have now lost 10 more people from the black community from this racial terror. And it's time for us to understand that we are fighting anti-Semitism.
I think sometimes the conversation gets divided according to victims, and then it can make it difficult to see the overarching thing. And so I think when some people hear you, they're going to say, anti-Semitism, this is about racism. But it's important to see the connections of those two streams.
That's right. We as black people have always faced the brunt of all forms of bigotry in American society. Along with indigenous communities, we have always been victimized by racism. But we have to be sophisticated enough, particularly those of us on the left, right, racial justice leaders. We have to be honest with our communities and help them understand what is happening. The attacks on Latinos in El Paso, in the Walmart that occurred in August of 2019, the targeting of Latinos at the Gilroy Garlic Festival, in 2019, the targeting of Jews at the Tree of Life, the targeting of African Americans in 2015 in Charleston. Yes, these were anti-Latino, these were anti-Black, these were attacks on Jews. But in all of those cases, and in many more, they were driven by this anti-Semitic narrative. And we have to let our people know that we are being targeted because of anti-Semitism. It doesn't take away from the racism. It doesn't take away from the xenophobia that Latinos and Asians are facing in this community. It is merely helping us understand where the driver is. And if we can disrupt the driver, perhaps we can begin to turn the violence around.
Well, attention right now is focused with reason on Fox News and Tucker Carlson and folks who had explicitly talked up white replacement theory for a long time, though apparently Fox has gone very quiet on it just now. But we've also seen establishment media fail to really be anti-racist, fail to vigorously defend inclusive democracy, as well as kind of a general framework that does tend to present political issues as zero sum, you know. And then again, when Les Moonves said Donald Trump might be bad for America, but he's good for CBS, so keep going, Donald. You know, that was just kind of dereliction of duty as far as I'm concerned. But as you have just indicated, we know there are more people who oppose this hateful worldview than support it. We know that although it's hard not to focus on horrific acts and hate crimes, we know that most people actually support the idea of participatory democracy and inclusive democracy and anti-racism. So I guess my question is just, what do you think is necessary to grow that movement? Where's the energy that we could present in that direction?
There is absolutely a pro-democracy movement that is building in the United States, but it's going to take a broad coalition, meaning left and progressive movements and leaders in the United States are going to have to come to terms with what it means to sit in broad coalition with others who may not be progressive or liberal. I'm not talking about it's a kind of mediocre kumbaya, we're going to get along and ignore our differences.
Right.
It means recognizing that there has to be a broad-based social movement that supports democracy as the functioning rule of law in the United States. And I think there are some things that folks can specifically do. So the first is simply this. The first is you have to begin to name that you are part of that pro-democracy movement in this country, right? A pro-democracy movement that opposes authoritarianism, that is opposed to bigoted and political violence, and demands that government step up and do its job, that it be of the people. So that's the first thing that needs to happen. The second is this pro-democracy movement needs to take media accountability, and that includes social media platforms. Seriously, we have places like Fox News Entertainment openly promoting a anti-Semitic theory that has been used in targeting minority communities across this country. Yes, shame on Fox News, but shame on the FCC. Shame on the Federal Trade Commission and shame on the Department of Justice for allowing that to happen without accountability and without consequence. Shame on international businesses who are engaging in business and commerce in the United States on the blood of minorities across this country who have been attacked over the last 5 years. Shame on law enforcement for putting ideology ahead of its mission to protect and serve.
I just want to ask you one final question, which is I know that you are a musician, and it sounds trite, but it's true that music and culture can be healing and can bring people together. And if you have thoughts on that space, I'd just be happy to hear them.
Yes, every musician and artist that is listening right now, if you work in arts, if you work within music, your voice and your energy is needed more than ever. We aren't hearing real stories on social media. We're being manipulated through algorithm, and we need the stories to be told, and stories get told also through music and through art. And it's time for artists to tell the real story of America, one that wants to move forward together. We need artists to tell the stories that won't get told during these times to keep us moving forward and to give us hope.
We've been speaking with Eric K. Ward from Southern Poverty Law Center and Western State Center. Thank you so much, Eric Ward, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russia's ruled out the prospect of talks to end the war in Ukraine after Ukrainian troops made major gains reclaiming territory seized by Russia after its invasion in February. On Monday, Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said the conflict would continue until Russia's goals had all been achieved. Meanwhile, Ukraine's appealing to the U.S. and its allies for more heavy weaponry. President Volodymyr Zelensky Monday urged the Pentagon to speed up deliveries of weapons systems, saying a pair of counteroffensive had broken in a weeks-long stalemate with Russia.
Since the beginning of September, our warriors have liberated more than 6,000 square kilometers of Ukrainian territory in the east and south of the country. Our troops are continuing to advance.
Later in the show, we'll look at how the war in Ukraine is leading to an energy war in Europe. We'll speak with the former Greek finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis. In the Caspian region, a November 2020 ceasefire between Azerbaijan and Armenia has unraveled as fresh fighting erupted over the disputed territory of Nagorno-Karabakh. Armenia says 49 of its soldiers were killed in clashes along its border with Azerbaijan. Meanwhile, Azerbaijan's foreign ministry accused Armenia of shelling civilian infrastructure in a large-scale provocation. 44 days of fighting in 2020 drove thousands of ethnic Armenians from their homes in Nagorno-Karabakh and claimed the lives of 7,000 people. The U.S. Justice Department has subpoenaed more than three dozen former aides of President Trump this week as it steps up its probe into efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Officials also seized the phones of Boris Epstein and Mike Roman, two people in Trump's orbit who sought to name alternative slates of electors in the states won by Biden. Meanwhile, the Justice Department said Monday it would accept Reagan-nominated federal former judge Raymond Deary as a special master to review hundreds of documents the FBI seized last month when it raided Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida. Many of the files were marked top secret. Trump's argued he declassified all the documents before leaving office. The Justice Department says it may still appeal the decision to appoint a special master, which came from U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon, who was nominated to the federal bench in 2020 by then President Trump. Pakistan's government is warning it could take up to 6 months for flood waters to recede after record monsoon rains and glacial meltwater
has left a third of Pakistan's territory underwater. The flooding uprooted 33 million people, has claimed over 1,400 lives. Public health officials are warning of the growing threat of waterborne diseases like cholera and dengue. On Monday, Pakistan's army raced to shore up flood defenses at a major power station in the southern province of Sindh, which supplies electricity to millions of people. Nearby, a major dust storm uprooted hundreds of tents at a camp for people recently made homeless by the climate disaster.
Our village, our town, were all submerged. We came here and we're living in tents. Now the tents have blown away and the weather has become so bad. It has started raining. Is there anyone who can help us? Please help us.
Public health officials are warning of worsening air quality across much of western North America as fire season heats up amidst a historic drought. In Canada, nearly 200 wildfires are burning across British Columbia. Among those forced to evacuate the flames Monday were 350 workers with the Trans Mountain Oil Pipeline Expansion Project. A thick pall of smoke has settled over the city of Vancouver, which had the worst air quality in the world Monday. Meanwhile, Seattle has experienced some of its worst air pollution in years. In Northern California, fire crews are battling the Mosquito Fire, which has burned nearly 65 square miles, threatening thousands of homes east of Sacramento. In Southern California, rescue crews pulled several trapped drivers from their vehicles Monday after the remnants of a rare post-tropical cyclone moved into the region, triggering flash flooding and mudslides. King Charles III is flying to Belfast, Northern Ireland today as mourners continue to gather at St. Giles Cathedral in Edinburgh when the body of Queen Elizabeth's coffin lies in rest. During the Queen's reign, more than 3,600 people died over three decades in Northern Ireland in fighting between the Irish Republican Army and forces backed by Britain. In 1979, an IRA bombing killed Lord Louis Mountbatten, the Queen's second cousin. In 2012, the Queen famously shook hands with former IRA leader and Sinn Féin politician Martin McGuinness in Belfast. Last week, Sinn Féin leader Michelle O'Neill paid tribute to the Queen.
There's no doubt that she leaves a legacy of someone who reached out the hand of friendship, someone who advanced peace and reconciliation, someone who sought to build relations between those of an Irish and those of a British identity. And I think that was sterling work and something that I think that should be very much remembered for here on this island.
Meanwhile, a 22-year-old man in Edinburgh was arrested Monday for heckling Prince Andrew over his ties to the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The protester was arrested after calling out, "Andrew, you're a sick old man." He was later filmed in handcuffs stating, quote, "powerful men shouldn't be allowed to commit sexual crimes and get away with it." A new United Nations report finds nearly one in every 150 people on Earth are trapped in situations of modern slavery on any given day, either compelled to work against their will or in a marriage that they were forced into. The Director General of the International Labour Organization, Guy Ryder, announced the findings Monday.
That's an extraordinary figure in this day and age, that there are, you know, 27.6 million people compelled to work. And the even worse news is this represents an increase over our previous estimates, which were published in 2017, an increase of 2.7 million.
The ILO says a further 22 million people around the globe are in forced marriages. The report notes, quote, "entrapment in forced labor can last years, while in most cases forced marriage is a life sentence," unquote. Back in the United States, 15,000 nurses in Minnesota have launched a three-day strike demanding wage increases, better patient care, and relief from staffing shortages. The Minnesota Nurses Association says it's the largest private sector nurses strike in U.S. history. Meanwhile, some 2,000 therapists, psychologists, social workers, and counselors at Kaiser Permanente clinics in California and Hawaii have entered the second month of a strike demanding better care for mental health patients. In more labor news, U.S. freight railroads have reduced service and Amtrak canceled trips on three long-distance routes as more than 110,000 rail workers threatened to go on strike this week to protest deteriorating working conditions. So far, 10 of 12 unions representing both freight and passenger rail workers have agreed to new contracts, but unions representing some 60,000 engineers and conductors remain in an impasse, and other workers have pledged to join if they begin a strike currently scheduled scheduled for 12:01 a.m. Friday. Workers want paid sick leave and say they're being pushed to work grueling schedules that their safety and that of the public. In Alabama, a black pastor who was arrested while watering his neighbor's flowers while they were away has filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against the city of Childersburg and the police officers involved in his arrest. Michael Jennings is the longtime pastor at Vision of Abundant Life Church in a nearby town. He's also a former police officer. His arrest took place in May, but police body cam footage was only recently released.
Do you live here?
No, I don't live here.
Okay. They're saying that this vehicle is not supposed to be here and you're not supposed to be
Who's
here.
Who's saying that?
They called about it. I don't know who called.
I'm supposed to be here. I'm Pastor Jennings. I live across the street.
You're Pastor Jennings?
Yes. I'm looking out for their house while they gone.
Okay.
Watering their flowers.
Okay. Well, that's cool. Do you have, like, ID? And
I don't know, man. I'm not going to give you no ID.
Why not?
I ain't did nothing wrong. Did
well, you look. Listen. I'm not saying do nothing wrong.
Doc, listen,
there's a suspicious person.
Police later handcuffed Pastor Jennings and arrested him on charges of obstructing government operations. And the pioneering French film director Jean-Luc Godard has died at the age of 91. His 1960 debut film, Breathless, helped define the French New Wave movement, which revolutionized cinema. Godard once said, quote, "A film consists of a beginning, a middle, and an end, though not necessarily in that order." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
What a difference a day made, 24 little hours, brought the sun and the flowers, where there used to be rain. My yesterday was blue, dear, today I'm part of you, dear, my lonely nights are through, dear, since you said you were mine. What a difference a day made. There's a rainbow before me. Eyes above can't restore me. Since that moment of bliss, that thrilling kiss, it's heaven when you find romance on your menu. What a difference a day made. And the difference is you.
Thank you. matter, and all day long you only stutter, cause your poor tongue just will not utter the word I love you. Oh, 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 what a little moonlight can do, oh, do to you. You wait a while till a little moonbeam comes peeping through. You'll get bold, you can't resist her, and all you'll say when you have kissed her is, oh, 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 what a little moonlight can do to you.
We'd like to tell you a story about a young girl, about 18 years old, about 5'2", and about to go out. Now her mother, realizing it was her first time out with a young man, called her into the bedroom and said, "Minnie, you're all dressed up in your finery, your very best clothes, and you look beautiful. You're gorgeous. You're alluring."
"Looks swell, baby."
"And now, Minnie, I want you to remember everything I've always told you. And above all, I want you to be very, very careful."
But she had to go and lose it at the after. She didn't take her mother's good advice. Now there aren't so many girls today who have one. And she'd never let it go for any price. They searched the place from penthouse to the cellar. In every room and underneath each bed. Once they thought they saw it lying on a pillow. But they found it belonged to someone else instead. But she had to go and lose it at the Astor. She didn't know exactly whom to blame. And she couldn't say just how or when she lost it. She only knew she had it when she came. They questioned all the bellboys and the porter. The chef appeared to be the guilty guy. And the doorman also acted quite suspicious. But he coyly said, "I'm sure it wasn't I." But she had to go and lose it at the Astor. It nearly killed her mother and her dad. Now they felt as bad about the thing as she did. After all, it was the only one she had. They just about completed all their searching when the chauffeur walked up with it in his hand. All they did was stand and gape. There was Minnie's sable cape. And she thought that she had lost it at the Astor.
But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Well, out your love, it's a honky-tonk parade. Well, out your love, it's a melody played in the penny arcade. It's a Bonham and Bailey world, just as phony as it can be. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Thank you.
Anybody home? Hello? Hello? Hello?
There you go. Can you hear me?
Yeah, gotcha.
I'm sorry. I was having some
No problem.
Issues.
Glitch, huh? Okay.
Yeah, I was telling the listeners it was pretty good weather out in the east coast of Pennsylvania.
Oh, it's a lovely day here. It's like probably in the 80s, you know, it's nice, beautiful, sunny day, you know. What more could you ask for, you know, a lovely day.
Yeah, really. I mean, yeah. Well, it's 86 here. That's supposed to be the high today,
yeah.
So.
Yeah, we're about the same here, yeah. Nice, bright day, a lot of blue sky. We had soaking rain, was it yesterday, the day before, all day long. And so all my plants, my tomato plants and squash, et cetera, everything's looking green and wonderful. And life is good.
Well, not in Pakistan.
Not in Pakistan and not in many, many, many places, certainly.
I heard that.
I'm fortunate.
Yeah, it was the Democracy Now! Clip I play, you know, every
mm-hmm.
show
mm-hmm.
I put in.
Mm-hmm.
Amy Goodman reports that almost a third of Pakistan is underwater and 33
yeah.
million people
yeah.
are homeless.
I heard
Jesus.
That number, a third of underwater. It's mind-boggling to think about that. Yeah, I know Bangladesh, of course, which used to be eastern Pakistan is always a mess, but, you know, Pakistan, huh? Yeah, I mean, terrible times. People are having terrible times.
And the wildfires in the West Coast and I guess
yeah.
up in Canada, too, now, so are screwing with the air quality. I don't see any of that out here.
I mean, it's kind of pathetic to say it, but, you know, I mean, humanity seems to be at some crossroad here, a major crossroad. It's like everything is coming unglued. But interesting, you know, you have the timing of the Queen's death in Britain after a 70-plus year reign. The longest reign of a royal in British history, to the point that Queen Elizabeth was considered taken for granted like a fact of life, you know, and all the issues and questions about the royal family and the king and queendom of Britain and, you know, the royal head of state and all this kind of stuff. Now is a major, major question because many Brits don't like who now is King Charles. You know, they're pretty much fed up with King Charles. And, of course, the issue with Diane finally, you know, knocked him out of the popularity box. So, the royal family in Britain is going to be in for a real problem. Because a lot of people are saying, well, why are we hanging around with this ancient institution? And a front page story today in the Times suggested that Prince Charles, the Prince of Wales until he became king, was much more savvy than his mother, and his portfolio is up in the billions of dollars. So this guy is so bloody rich, and plus he's going to inherit all of his mother's money, and so he's going to be one rich SOB, and, you know, countries like Jamaica and all the other hundreds of former Commonwealth countries are beginning to say, what the hell, why do we need this British king as our head of state, if, you know, symbolically, when, you know, in places like Kenya, you know, she oversaw, in her benignness, this horrible treatment and bloody violence and torture of people in Kenya. And, you know, all of that stuff now is going to rise to the surface and become an issue, you know. And so that whole change, if you will, is going to be profound. And, you know, we have a new – it was interesting. 2 days before she died, she accepted the new prime minister. So, you know, the loss of the queen and the new king – and a new prime minister, and all of that Brexit stuff, and, you know, all of that's now hovering in the air in Britain. And so it's going to be very, very interesting what happens there. You know, and, you know, you look at all this colonial stuff, you know, the bitterness and the grievances of colonial countries that were colonized by the Brits over hundreds of years. Terrible abuse and violence and exploitation, things like that. Now, you know, all of that's going to be reopened. That wound is going to be reopened, and, you know, people are going to want to discuss that. And, of course, analogous in the United States, you know, we have our own oppression and exploitation issues with, you know, slaughter of Indians and slavery and Jim Crow, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That, of course, in states like the Trumpian states like Florida now, you talk about that and you make young children sad, you know, that's going to be censored. So all of that stuff about the British Empire and all the dirty little details about the British Empire, which are now going to be exposed because of the change of the royalty, you know, there's the analogous issue in the United States that we're now dealing with, the censorship to, oh, no, no, we can't talk about the abuses in the past because little Johnny might be upset and might cry and might be sad that his people were bloody murderers and things like that. Anyway, you know, this is all in my mind, you know, and
yeah.
I don't know. What do you think? I've gone along long enough here.
No, that's all right. I'm still trying to figure out why.
What?
Who would bring this up to a little child anyhow? I mean, but yeah, a lot of this stuff I was sort of,
right, of course.
Shielded from this till like an eighth and ninth.
Right.
You know, I mean, and half the time you couldn't even find it in the history textbook.
Right.
I mean,
of course.
I dug around on my own, and but now, this is the thing about the internet. I mean, universal access to all human
knowledge. Absolutely,
And you can't hide all this stuff anymore.
Yeah. Well,
you know?
That's the thing. That's exactly the point. Is that, you know, at the time that this stuff is burgeoning out and exploding, information exploding in the world because of the internet, you know, Ron DeSantis is like a dictator, always do, trying to shut this stuff down. But, it's become like trying to catch, you know, spilled bottle of mercury on the floor. You know, you just can't get it. It's just so intractable a problem to try to shut down information in an age when information is exploding everywhere, you know. So power becomes much more important than truth in that kind of world, because people with power want to hold on to their power and their wealth and all that stuff. They don't want anybody asking, like, some poor, dirt poor shitbag asking, like, oh, how did he get all that money, you know?
Well,
you know, and wait a minute, how does King Charles, how come he's a $3 billion? Where did that come from? On whose back did he get all that money, you know? And, you know, people start asking these very simple, basic questions, you know?
Yeah, right.
You know, it's like you get to the point, you know, we used to say in the military when we didn't like an officer, well, he gets up in the morning and puts his pants on just like
pants
we
on.
Do, you know? And she says,
right,
wait
right.
a goddamn minute here, you know what I mean?
I think the vast turnout for Queen Elizabeth's funeral is more of an indicator of respect. I mean, I'm sort of interested that there hasn't been anything but some hecklers, a couple hecklers, you know, and a few people holding up some handmade signs, you know. I'm really sort of impressed with that.
I think that's true, and I think life is complicated, and Queen Elizabeth was a lovable queen, you know what I mean? Since she took over as a child. And in fact, I hate to say this, this is a tongue-in-cheek remark, but I think the institution of the king or queen and royalty in England would be sustainable much better if they could somehow eliminate King Charles and install King William and his lovely wife and these two beautiful children, you know, and suddenly now we have a little tink, you know, we have a romantic story. Oh my God, this is so wonderful, you know, the soap opera quality of it, and King William and what's her name, the queen, they don't have any baggage, you know, she'd be the real queen, she wouldn't be a queen consort, remind us of Diane and all that, and so they could start all over again.
Yeah,
so,
why not?
We just got to get rid of Charles, that's all. I'm kidding. I'm just kidding now. I'm just kidding.
Oh, boy. Get rid of boring old Charles. I mean,
you know, I have a friend of mine, Bill Jefferson, who lives in Maine, was his father, I guess he had a little money, his father sent him to a private school in Scotland, I think it was. And his schoolmate in his class was Prince Charles. He hung with Prince Charles and went to school with Prince Charles at the school in Scotland.
Wow.
Yeah, that was pretty amazing.
That is amazing. Well, I got up this morning, and I haven't been trolling or watching this very carefully, but I got up this morning, and they're still burying her. I guess they were taking her coffin to Scotland or somewhere, I don't know, Edinburgh, and I don't get all the history too much, you know, of why she's being set up there, and Charles is walking behind the hearse. That's what it is, the hearse.
Right.
And all these guys in their kilts, their skirts,
We're in Scotland. They're in Scotland. Yeah,
and their hair hats, the big hair. Yeah. I don't know what that is.
I mean, that was a pretty amazing packed-in street with, I mean, thousands of people jammed in there. You wonder about the security and all that stuff. Wow.
I've noted that the racks that were holding the crowd, setting up the line for the crowd, were identical to the racks that were used by the January 6th rioters.
We're familiar with those racks. You know, I remember the cattle chutes over the years when they, you know, demonstrations became choreographed with cattle chutes. Remember over the, you know, the anti-war stuff, and, you know, you'd have the cattle chutes would lead you into a, quote, First Amendment zone, which is a half a mile from the object you're protesting, and you get into this cattle chute of First Amendment zone, and the cops, you can say anything you fucking want here in the free expression zone, the First Amendment.
Right.
Of course, nobody can hear what the hell you're saying, but
you're saying
you can say anything you want. It's America, you know. And,
That's right.
Right. Yeah.
When I first saw the riot take off on January 6th, I was looking at those racks, and I thought, well, those look like bicycles. They look like bicycle racks to me.
I think that's what they are, in a way. Yeah.
Oh, well.
I think, you know, they have double duty there, you know.
Yeah. And I thought, those look like bicycle racks. That's not going to hold back these yahoos and deplorable podunks of my neighbors would walk right through that stuff, you know what I mean?
Right. Well, that's what they did. They pushed them aside.
Used them as weapons on the four.
Yeah,
cops.
You pick two people pick it up and you run right at the cops with this big goddamn metal thing. That's like when I was at the 2000 demonstrations in Philadelphia for the Republican convention when they nominated George W. Bush, and we had huge, huge marches that day. And there were cops, they're cops in their spandex, and they had their bicycles, and these bicycle cops, you know, in spandex. And the cops would pick up their bikes, you know, grab them, and they'd use them as battering rams, their own damn bicycles. They'd hit you right in the chest with it, you know, with a bicycle.
Uh-huh.
You'd get a pedal right in the stomach, you know, or something.
Well, that'd be better than a horse.
That's true.
Yeah, whore,
stepped on
a
by
horse,
a horse. You don't want that.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, that's I've had that happen.
That's whoosh.
Out here in the 10 acres, I've had a horse step on my foot, man. You
don't
want
really?
That to
oh,
happen.
My. Wow.
Oh, yeah. I was just glad that it was soft dirt.
Yeah,
been
there
on
you go.
Street pavement.
Yeah.
You, know, and,
you would have crushed
their horses,
it. Huh?
Oh, yeah, and the police horses are shoed. They have shoes. So
yeah, your horses don't have shoes or what?
No, okay. You don't need shoes.
But they're still hard.
Right,
they'll
still,
all
oh,
that
yeah.
weight on this, like, you know, 5 inches of diameter, and it's going to crush
they're
you.
Easily at that. Yeah, easily 1,000 pounds. I mean, you know,
Well, I know. You know, I was in the Army out of Fort Huachuca. They had a stable. You know, you could go, you know, rent some horses. And, of course, these are stable horses, and they're used to people who don't know how to ride a horse, and they try to rip your head off by running you under a tree and stuff like that. really, I mean, it's like, oh, God damn, I got another one of these clowns. I want to just knock him off, you know. And so I was
right,
on one
right,
of these
right.
horses that was just, you know, didn't really want to ride me around. Anyway, I took him over this creek, and it was a sandy creek, and his foot sunk in, and he fell over in the creek, and his ass rolled right over me. So
yeah,
it's seared into my brain vision of this me sunk down in the water in the sand, and this humongous horse's ass rolling right over me, you know? And because it was soft sand, I was pressed into
you're
it.
You're lucky.
I wasn't crushed.
You're really lucky.
You know?
You're lucky.
I am. Yeah.
Lucky.
Yeah.
I mean, I've only been to one I would call police riot involving horses,
uh-huh,
and it was in Washington. It was in Washington D.C. back in the when
right.
I was crazy in the early '80s.
Oh, back then,
and,
back when you were crazy, Michael.
Yeah, I was crazy, Michael. Yeah. Now I'm still crazy, but I'm harmless now. Harmless crazy.
Now
yeah.
You're crazy, Mike. Maybe it's
crazy
Michael.
Mike, right? And I didn't have any part of it. I didn't really know. I was just attending. It was a demonstration, and it turned into a police. I mean, the police really provoked it. And they here the horses. They had I don't know a dozen horses or so over on the side.
Mm-hmm.
In the side street, nobody really saw the horses until they come barreling in on a crowd. Yeah, I and a guy from Haiti, a black guy from Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
We just hailed a cab. We just walked down the street and got in a cab and rode off while the riot was going on.
There you go.
It's like I told his name is Rostan.
Right.
I told Rostan, I said. He had an umbrella, and he
right.
was, I said, "Don't be careful. They'll come down on you with that umbrella." So we scampered down the street. We just ran, scampered down the street while all this screaming and yelling was going on
right.
in the background.
And got a cab.
And I was looking. Yeah, I looked over the shoulder, and he used the umbrella to flag down this cab that was driving by. We jumped in, and I told Ross, I said, "Man. I'm from Kansas. I'm not used to this kind of stuff."
Sheltered life.
Yeah, that was the last time I ever really got that close to bad stuff happening on the street. So
that reminds me of the time I was in El Salvador. I was photographing Roberto Dobasan at a demonstration. And a baracho, a drunk, started pointing me out and making a big noise. And all of his thugs in the stand were looking at me. And I said, "Oh, shit, man." this is time for me to go. So I made a very smooth exit and grabbed a cab and got the fuck out of there right away.
Because
Roberto Dobasan, you're not supposed to, I didn't realize it, but I figured out at the time I was the only photographer there, and nobody was photographing him, and he was a dirty little secret on the part of the right, because he was the guy that found it. He's known as, of course, Blowtorch Bob for his favorite torture method. And and so I figured, well, John, maybe you don't know what the fuck you're doing here. Maybe you should get out of this right away. It was very pretty.
Well, he did cut. Dombasan did cut loose the death squads. He let them go. He let them do whatever they want. Right?
Well, he's the one who created them, pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. He's
cashiered major, I think. You know, they'd run him out of the service.
Yeah, I mean that's another thing. See, that's another thing about access to knowledge. You know, I mean internet. That's the redeeming feature, but it also is sort of a feature of chaos because, I mean, at the same time, you wrote this fantastic article about the QAnon, conspiracy phenomenon.
Sure.
Yeah, that's a great article.
Remember that? Yeah, we forget.
Yeah. I mean, so you get 10,000 crazy people, you know, driven by conspiracy theories, which, you know, and it's from... That's why I get annoyed with, unidentified sources in the journalism business. And even the New York Times, it really makes me, I get upset about it because I think, this is how people get all stirred up because and they're stirred up by people who you don't even know who they are, who are telling you this stuff, you know. And
sure.
I don't know. Didn't it used to be very controversial to use unknown sources or unsighted sources?
Right, I think that's just the unfortunately the nature of the times that nobody wants to go on record. They're afraid. Everybody's terrified these days. You know, there used to be a little decorum and etiquette back in the old days. You know, nowadays if you're it's more to the bone. You know, every decision you make is more sort of potentially life and death in a way in the culture we live in. There's so much potential for got you. Ah, you got you. You didn't know by revealing that little tidbit of information that we were going to twist it around like this and end up strangling you with a damn little bit of information. You just don't know what's going to happen with anything. And so, it's crazy. I mean, look at trying to indict Donald Trump for crimes that everybody, you know, the telephone call to the guy in Georgia is, you know, evidence of a crime right there. And everyone in America has heard it 16 times, you know what I mean? Still, because it's the evidence doesn't come across as real evidence. We live in a very, very strange time. I think that's an understatement.
Yeah. Well, at the front, you know, I'll tell you this. I got to give a hat tip, and I don't always do it because PBS sometimes pisses. PBS pisses me off sometimes, you know.
Sure.
But
sure.
This latest Frontline documentary, which listeners, it's free available on YouTube. It really opened my eyes to see things like I'd forgotten that Lindsey Graham had, you know, literally turned himself around. First then he gets mad at Donald Trump. He says, "I've had enough is enough on the floor of the Senate." The night after the day of the riot.
Yeah.
That's what he said. He said, "I've had it. It's enough.
Yeah.
Enough is enough." And now, less than in that documentary, here he is, like less than a month later, out playing golf with the guy.
Hold up. Frontline is great. What is the Frontline you're talking about?
I'm going to – I'll look it up while you're talking. It's on – it's available on YouTube. It's called it just came out, literally, last week.
Okay.
It aired. And it's, you know, like you can replay it on
YouTube. But what's
YouTube
the theme? What's the topic? What's it about?
I'm looking – oh, it's about – that's what it's about. It's about the –
what?
It's like the January 6th.
Oh, okay,
January 6th.
I didn't know.
And Don,
but
and
so
Donald
Lindsey Graham is sort of featured in it, or, yeah?
No, he's just one of the characters on it.
Gotcha.
And,
I got you. Okay, good. Yeah.
And I'll find it here. I'll give you the name of it. It just and I watched it, and I really because it put it in perspective. You know what I mean?
Frontline's
really,
great. Yeah, I agree. Frontline's great.
Yeah, I mean, it put it into a perspective. It's like, look here. It shows you the people actually flip-flopping.
Yeah.
These politicians flip-flopping for
all of them came out immediately after damning Trump and saying this was a crime and all that. And, it, you know, within, you know, 2 days they had flipped. It was just incredible, you know. And, you know, and this should be a lesson for everybody to see how this happened. So it's good that Frontline reminds us of this. And, of course, Lindsey Graham. I mean, Lindsey Graham has to be, you know, one of the low-crawling snakes of the business. It's just, you know, and the whole Bill Maher, you know, the last three shows Bill Maher has done, he has made some outrageous, humiliating joke, you know, about Lindsey Graham, and the last one was a Friday night, I guess he said. He said, I forgot even what the theme was, and at the end, it was the end of his new rules at the end, at the close, and he has this pathetic picture of Lindsey Graham. And he makes this joke, well, Lindsey Graham was decided that he would be the one to take the anal probe. And you're going like, whoa, man, this poor guy. Yeah. And I don't know why the anal probe was an issue, but, you know, it was you know, we all got it, you know. And
Well, here it is. It's called Lies, Politics, and Democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Lies, Politics, and Democracy, and it's available. It was released 6 days ago, and it's available on the Frontline YouTube channel, free. It's over an hour. It's almost 2 hours long. And it's really is an eye-opener. I encourage Republicans, everybody, all the listeners, to check
that out. Yeah, I think you can get
out.
That on demand, possibly, if you have cable, but I'm not sure.
You know what? I've been looking around. You got it. Yeah, you can get it on YouTube. It's free on the Frontline YouTube channel. Just put search Frontline documentaries, and it'll take you right to their channel, to their YouTube channel. But you know, you need to. I think you need to donate now. Maybe not Frontline, but PBS has this weird. If you have to donate, it's like a paywall for five. I think a minimum of $5 a month. Then they give you a thing called Passport, and then you can watch all this shit online. But this is available: Lies, Politics, and Democracy. That's the name of the documentary.
Check it out. Yeah,
very, very eye opening in terms of the man, I'd forgotten how Donald Trump had treated Ted Cruz and his wife, and even his father. And his kids. I mean, I'd forgotten all that. And Cruz went right along with it. I mean, that's like you beat a dog and the dog comes back and licks your feet. Well, that's pretty.
Yeah,
that's
Donald.
Sad.
I mean, you look back at the saga of Donald Trump and you go, how can this man get away with making the public statements that he does? And the one, you know, just came to my mind for some reason that a man would say this publicly, you know, about his daughter Ivanka, you know, and he said, you know, if she wasn't my daughter, I'd date her, you know. It's like, what? What?
Right. Exactly.
I mean, who else could get away with something like that? you know.
Yeah, she's nice. And if she weren't my daughter, I'd date her. You know, like, what? You fucking creep, you know, like, God.
Somehow they were talking dick size on the campus.
I don't know about that one.
The size of the hands.
Episode.
Something to do with size of the hands and.
Oh, well, remember that, his little hands, and, of course, little hands in the chest.
Yeah.
And, of course, I just saw, I saw this really, really stupid movie about Donald Trump. And it was about, and it was some clown show made it. But it was one of those bad, bad movies that were really fun and interesting. And it was like, the whole thing was that Donald Trump had made a deal with the devil, and the devil was like this hip hop black dude, you know, and he was getting Donald Trump and signing him up in blood and all this, and every, you know, it had all and followed all the incidents of Donald Trump's recent life, and you know, each one was played up as if somehow the devil was involved, and yeah, it was just kind of hilarious because it had all these things in it, and what can you say? You know, what can you say?
Yeah, well, why did I guess so many people vote for him? Because earlier I played, you know, listeners in the first hour heard Counterspin,
uh-huh.
And they were talking, they were interviewing, who were they interviewing? Some guy on. Works at Media Matters,
right.
And they were talking about this. They talked about this thread of the Great Replacement series,
right, of course.
These mass shooters going out, and the one that went up in upstate New York and targeted a black grocery store and killed all those people up there.
Right.
And he was a goddamn teenager. I did not know that he was that young.
Yeah.
And then Kyle Rittenhouse
he's a millionaire.
He's a millionaire now.
Kyle Rittenhouse is a problem. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. And Tucker Carlson was partly, you know, blew him up like incredible.
Well, that's what they talked about. That guy, Tucker Carlson. I don't have cable.
Oh, Tucker Carlson. Yeah. Tucker Carlson, you know, Sean Hannity's one thing. But Tucker Carlson is just a low-crawling, smarmy son of a bitch. I don't know. He is, they're just talking about him now with this Ukraine thing about how he, you know, is so delighted with how the Russians are so powerful in Ukraine and sort of, you know, what's the American far right going to do now that suddenly there's huge, huge questions about Putin's invasion of Ukraine because the Ukrainians just, you know, sucker punched him and took a large part of the northeastern areas that the Russians had, you know, the Russians were just running and fleeing and retreating. And apparently now there are people who are actually ponying up and saying that this war is wrong. And you know, there was a piece yesterday on one of the MSNBC shows on, you know, going through all these Russians on TV saying, you know, the war is terrible and we need to negotiate a way out of this war. And there's 40 people in some institution went on record demanding that Vladimir Putin resign for treason. I mean, they did this in public.
Happen.
Huh? I know it's
never
going to happen. But what I'm saying is this stuff is now publicly bubbling up inside Russia, which is all new. This is really new.
Yeah.
That after a while, you know, if enough people protest, you know, critical mass issues come in and, you know, he's going to be, you know, really impotent. I mean, you can't slaughter all of these 40 people end up dead, you know, I mean, that's pretty obvious. So at some point, you know, Vladimir Putin may be, you know, in some trouble here. Now, my question, this is my question, my particular little turf that I've been, nurturing, is that the linkage between the far right and the far left, the frustrated far right, far left, the frustrated populist far right and the populist far left, their linkages, because they hate the American deep state so much, you know, that they have linkages, affinities, and you see them on the Tucker Carlson show. So what does this mean for the far left when suddenly, you know, Vlad may be having some problems over there? I don't know. There's a couple of friends of mine who are, you know, constantly apologists for Russia and Putin that I want to sort of, you know, diplomatically ask them, well, what the hell's next? You know, what do you, you know, at what point, you know, does this affinity with Vladimir Putin fall apart for the left? At what point does the left then become, elements of the left become, you know, chumps for the right and things like that? And, you know, this is my own little turf that I pay attention to, but I think at some point it's going to come back and, you know, bite the far left because, you know, there's no, there seems to be no future in that. But anyway, that's, again, I'm kind of veering off into my...
The one thing I think you're right about...
area
the future, there's one thing, I think you're right. The one thing that there is no future, it seems like, mm-hmm. is peace.
Yeah.
And anti-war.
Yeah. Gotcha.
I mean, and that's the sickness of the...
Right.
Of
I think
the,
you're right.
Of the, discuss, the discussion...
You're right.
And it's Scott Ritter, who I pay attention to.
Sure, I don't remember him.
This is just a temporary thing, and that he's changed his writing style. Now he just calls it NATO.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even Ukrainian. They're not Ukrainian. It's NATO intelligence. NATO.
Well,
weapons,
NATO's the
NATO
big bugaboo. That, you know that they hate. Yeah, obviously.
Yeah. Well, they're. I mean,
well, I think they're right, too. I think they're right. As I've told my buddy, who is an apologist for Putin, et cetera, you know, I said, look, the difference between you and me is my view is a plague on both their houses. You know what I mean? The East and the West and all that. Instead of, you know, my enemy's enemy is my friend, that sort of thing, you know. There's no future in that. Again, my strategy here is, okay, we're screwed, a plague on both their houses. As I explained to somebody after these two elections coming up, you know, our midterms and in 2024, that the decisions are that the fact of the matter is we, the population of the United States, especially those of us who aspire to peace and decency and dignity and all that kind of stuff, you know, the situation for us is we're basically fucked. Pardon the expression. We're just basically fucked. And the question is, the question is for the midterms and the election in 2024, how fucked are we going to be? You know, instead of, you know, the lesser of two evils, it's graduated beyond that to how fucked do you want to be? You know what I mean? Vote for the Democrats and you're still going to be fucked. You know, we all know the Democrats and the deep state and all that stuff, the war in Ukraine, which is a disaster. But then again, you know, the alternative would be a Donald Trump-like president. And, okay, that would probably solve the Ukraine war. You know, he would, in some ways. But in the end, you know, we would be, again, to pardon expression, we would be much more fucked if that's the way it went. Anyway, that's my particular view. I don't know. What do you think?
Know,
it may be stupid. Maybe that's stupid.
No, it's a plague on both houses. That's what I say.
Yeah, exactly.
A plague on both your houses. And I get annoyed when listening to the far right, which is everywhere, it seems
to
me.
Right.
They're much more popular than the, and available on the media than
well,
whatever
sexy.
You call
they're
far left.
They're very sexy.
I don't know about sexy. I don't know about that.
Well, that's a term in journalism for exciting. In other words, there's
well, we
more exciting.
We tried this last week. Right, yeah, okay.
Oh, I guess we did, didn't we?
Well, yeah, it's sexy to me.
It's like a marriage here, the same stories over and over again.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense. Okay, I never thought of it that way. I really never did. I mean,
I don't know how.
Sexy. I guess it's optics. The new word is optics.
Okay.
Optics, I think. But, hey, listen, after the Biden soul of a country speech, and he used the word semi-fascist, quote-unquote semi-fascist.
Whatever that means.
Immediately, what you would call the hard right started calling the Democrats and Biden fascists. So you got both sides.
Oh, I know.
Calling each other fascists. I mean, what do you do about this?
Is this the same phenomenon?
The right
has turned that dynamic into an art. In other words, if the left says, well, you're a fascist, well, then the right will come back and say, no, you're a fascist. And so it just confuses the population so much that, you know, nobody knows which way is up anymore, you know, because, what's this guy Goldberg years ago wrote this book about liberal fascism, you know, that really it's that the liberals are derivative of Nazism. I'm going like, what? Huh? Who? Well, I'm just watching. I'm up to the third episode, I think, of this series on Netflix of Hitler's inner circle, and it's very interesting how Hitler became this sort of nobody in the beer halls to be who he became. And it goes back to this guy, Gerhard Eckert, I think his name was, who was a bit of a drunk, but he was an intellectual, and he wrote things. He was a good writer, and you know, he would go to the beer halls, where everybody was, you know, their dissatisfaction with the Treaty of Versailles and, you know, of course, how they were raped by the Allies and all this. We know this. This is what led to Hitler. They put this huge debt on Germany that was just impossible for them. And they were just starving and living in misery. And all these, these proud, you know, military types just couldn't abide by this, so these beer halls things started, and the people would go, and one day this guy Gerhard Dietrich heard Hitler. Hitler originally had been with the military, and he was going to the beer hall to spy on these, you know, civilian fascist sort of little pods in these beer halls. Well, he realized that he was so empathetic with them and understood that he started speaking at these places and stopped being a spy and began speaking. And this guy, Gerhard Eckert, heard him and said, wow, this guy is something. Because Gerhard Eckert was looking for a messiah. That was a word he kept using, a messiah, to bring justice to Germany because of the way they were treated by Versailles, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that's all in the history. It's all in Leni Riefenstahl's Reifenstahl's The Triumph of the Will and all this stuff. Well, this guy, you know, Hitler was a passionate speaker, you know, the really pissed off vet that he was. But he'd stumble around, and he just didn't have a system, didn't have clarity and organization. And this guy, who was a writer, took him under his wing, and the two became very, very close. And he groomed Hitler into making his speeches not only passionate but organized and lucid and simple enough to be grippable, right? And he sort of manufactured this Hitler, and then Hitler went on his own and completely ignored this guy in the end, and he died as a drunk. And then he developed all these, like Hess,
Hess was his obsessive secretary, almost. The guy was just so obsessed with him. And then he had...
Sort of the Steve Bannon. He sort of was Steve Bannon, I suppose,
but he was much more passive than you think of these people.
Hess did jail time.
Hess did jail time. And Rome. Rome is the decadent, fat slob that was the sadistic killer that ran the SA, and ended up in the Night of the Long Knives. We haven't gotten to that yet, you know, where Rome.
What's the name of the series?
It's Hitler's Inner Circle, I think it was called.
Oh.
And Himmler was a wannabe. Himmler was this, reminds me of Stephen Wright, I think it was, under Trump. Steve Miller. He was this wannabe. Yeah. He looked like Steve Miller, the actor, anyway, he played him. He wants to be a military, but he didn't go in the military. So he is a wannabe military guy, a little spindly guy who lives with his parents, right? He wanted to be a military guy, and so he ends up, in his aspirational affinity with Hitler and all this, he ends up establishing and creating and leading the SS. You know, here's a guy, a wannabe military man, had never had any military experience at all, just simply wanted to play soldier. So he creates this, you know, there's no limits here, this heinous, murderous group, the SS. And, you know, who was the World War One ace that became a morphine addict because he was shot during the beer putsch, you know, remember the famous beer putsch? And so it's really, you know, I know a little of this, but I never really put it together like this series.
Right. Yeah.
And it was all sort of an accident of things, you know, random things kind of together, but there was this soil out there that this Messiah would somehow speak to, and obviously did. And, it had happened. And, you know, we have a similar sort of soil here. I mean, the analogies with the Nazis are always troublesome. But this soil, this political soil in America that's disgruntled and full of grievances and everybody's pissed off, so there are similarities that this rise of authoritarianism and down of the fading of democracy around the world, it's not just here, it's everywhere, you know, in this world we have in 2022. It's always interesting to see how things came together in the past. And so the series is very interesting. I think it's called Hitler's Inner Circle. Now, of course, with Rome, this guy, Rome, the actor who plays, it's a documentary and there's some reenactments. The actor has such a extended, huge belly. So this Rome must have been a decadent, fat slob. But he was, once Hitler came into power, Rome and his henchmen, he had I guess it was the SS or an element of the SS, or camp, and then it led to Hitler finally, you know, killing them all. It was the Night of the Long Knives when they kind of slaughtered a lot of Rome's men because they were, you know, apparently a cabal of homosexuals, a very decadent stuff going on. These militarist killers, you know, and it was that they were just threatening Hitler, and so he wiped him out, the Night of the Long Knives, and that's obviously going to be coming up in this show. But, it's a real assortment of whack jobs here, you know, and of course Goebbels comes in.
Is this on Netflix?
It's on Netflix.
Okay, good, because we got to give these working class people out here where you can get it at. I've got one, and I'm going to I'll be very quick about it.
Sure.
It's a podcast, and it's put together by a guy named Dan Arrows, who I believe lives in Germany. He is German. He speaks with a very distinct German accent. And it's called Iron, the irondice.com. Iron Dice, D-I-C-E. You know, the stuff
Iron,
you know, the Dice. Game.
Okay.
Iron D-I-C-E, Dice.
Okay.
Did you get it? D-I-C-E, like the dice you throw.
Right, Iron Dice, okay.
And it's called TheIronDice.com.
Okay.
And this guy is doing a series. He started in October, and it's called The Fight for the Republic.
Right.
And it's really a deep dive, very similar to what you're talking about,
right,
except it's
right.
a podcast.
Sure.
And it's, let's see, I'm looking at it. It's a six-part series, and they are each about an hour long. And then he most notably put up August 17th, 2022, mm-hmm. His latest entry is America's Coming Weimar Moment.
America's Coming Weimar Moment. Analogy, absolutely, with the Weimar Republic. I mean, the Weimar Republic was noted for its impotence and not doing anything. And, well, hello, have we heard of this dynamic before?
These are absolutely fantastic. He, on YouTube, he's known as Three Arrows. Now, I don't know what that means, his name is Dan Arrows, and it's TheIronDice.com, where you can get access. And I found this. I've been listening to it in the last few days through the Majority Report. What's his name?
Right.
Sam Cedar. He had listeners to his show,
mm-hmm.
you know, call in, and they're talking about. So it's receiving some kind of big reviews on the what you would call. Well, what is Sam Cedar in the Majority? It's left. It's
mm-hmm.
from Air America Day. It's like Air America used to be. That's where you
okay.
got started.
Right. I remember that.
Yeah. So it's called TheIronDice.com, and it's a series called Fight for the Republic, and it's a deep history dive, like you're talking
right.
about.
Right.
Into the lead-up to Hitler and World War II. It's the lead-up to. And so I heartily recommend. I've only listened to three of them. Of the
Say
six
the name of it
segments.
Again. Iron Dice.
The Iron Dice.
Okay.
Yeah, The Iron Dice. And
the recent New Yorker, which I think you get, right? Do you still get that?
Yeah.
And I may renew it here. Anyway, the has a story on this new dictator. He's calling himself a dictator in El Salvador. Bukele, I forget his first name, Nayib Bukele, something like that. You know, he's a Palestinian. He's a Muslim. He's the president of El Salvador. And he formerly was connected to the FMLN. I mean, he comes out of the left. And he is tooting himself up to be quite the dictator. And according to this, he's the most popular leader now in Central and South America, according to this thing. But the point is, two things. One, he did recently, he's had some issue with the National Assembly. I think that's what it's called. Well, one day he comes down to the National Assembly. There's a protest. He's called a protest. His friends are all around the National Assembly, and I think it's probably a Sunday or something. It's not in session, right? So suddenly Bukele comes with an entourage of SUVs, and they all get out, and he's got bodyguards and armed soldiers, and they all go into the legislature, and he calls a special session and does what he wants because he's got the army with him. And so his final statement is like, I guess we now know who's in charge here, you know, and then he leaves.
Jesus God.
And this is a guy who comes out of the FMLN. Of course, the FMLN, you know, in 2010, I went to the inauguration of Mauricio Funes, the first FMLN president of El Salvador, who ended up, I believe, in jail, sad to say. But the FMLN and the ARENA are both, you know, left and right parties. The FMLN used to be guerrillas, now that's a political party. So he has his own party called New Ideas. And so he has come out of this Salvadoran war as a dictator who, again,
segues out of the FMLN and all that. There was a shot I saw of in the prison where, you know, MS-13, the gangs, he is going, he said he's going to shut down MS-13. And he's going about it in a very dictatorial way. And he arrests people like crazy. A lot of them are innocent. And there was a scene in a prison, major prison, of all these guys in their underwear with all these tattoos, MS-13 tattoos, real tough-looking guys, you know. And there was probably about 100 of them. And they were in the square surrounded by many, many armed men. And these men were forced to come up and squat down literally right up next to the guy in front of them and the guy on the right. So there was this block of all these men scrunched up, squatting together in their underwear.
Wow.
And you're going like, holy shit, man, they have intimidated these very tough guys. So, I mean, this is one tough-ass prison, let me tell you. And you go like, oh, my God, this is what El Salvador has turned into, you know? It's like, you know, you go, because I remember I was there a number of times in the 80s, and, of course, you know, there was always some danger, you know. But then when 92, when the war was declared over, after the war was over, you're traveling around El Salvador, you felt much more dangerous. To me, it was much more dangerous. Because
really?
There were, it was criminals now. I mean, we were fine with the guerrillas. I mean, we were friends with the guerrillas, if you will, when we were traveling around there. But now, I remember we were on this in this van. I think there was about six of us. And this small car comes up next to us, and this kid, literally, he's probably 18, is waving a .45 automatic out the window at us, right? And he comes up, he passing our van, and he goes, blam, 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 right in front of the driver. And then he pulls over to the left, and we stop, and we're looking at them, and, you know, and all this stuff. And somebody comes by in a truck, and he stops, and he saw what happened. He says, look, I have a pistol on the seat here. Go ahead. I will proceed behind you. And, you know, we went, and everybody looked at each other, and, you know, we were fine. But, you know, that's sort of the anarchy of it all, you know, was scary because, you know, when we deal with the military, you know, we had blue passports, and they weren't going to harm a hair on our head. And then, of course, when we went across the lines into Chalatenango, into the rebel zones and places like that, they were delighted to see us. And so, you know, this was when the war was on, so it was actually safer than post-war, you know what I mean, because of crime and that sort of thing. And it's this world where the gangs were created that is now the horrifying aspect of El Salvador that this guy Bukele is, you know, trying to rein in. And so where it's going is kind of frightening and uncertain. So, I mean, it's like Mexico and all, you know, the gangs in Mexico are just out of hand, you know. And,
I worry about that out here. I worry about that happening in this country. I do. I really
Absolutely. It's like a canary in the mine when you look at all that stuff. You go like, oh, my God. You see signs of that developing here, and it's kind of you know, the idea of crime and politics getting confused, you know, power and politics and crime getting all mixed up. Anyway, on that note.
John Grant.
On that note, Gwen Swift, good luck.